I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. New polls show a clear message to members of Congress. Only 8% of Americans think they deserve re-election. 8%. The latest New York Times CBS poll also shows that the public largely blames George W. Bush for the country's economic problems, and President Obama gets slightly higher marks for bipartisanship than Republicans. But as to Congress, some members are already exiting. So far, 33 incumbents have decided not to run this year, including Congressman Patrick Kennedy of Rhode Island, the son of the late Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy, whose Patrick's announcement last night means there will be no Kennedy in Congress for the first time in 60 years. Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News, also author of the network's blog, The Note. And Rick, your overall thoughts on the poll results, especially for the Obama administration?
Well, you know, almost buried in this poll is the fact that his approval rating is at the lowest point of his presidency.
But that's still 46%.
Right. And much better than Congress and much better than Republicans. The troubling thing for Democrats is that Obama himself won't be on the ballot. It's going to be Democrats versus Republicans this year in congressional districts, and that's where Democrats look a lot weaker. I think there's a glimmer of optimism for the White House, though. If they can continue to highlight areas of Republican obstructionism, there's still a base of support there for President Obama that's greater than really any other Washington institution right now. But everybody tends to look bad in this kind of climate.
Well, and we want to hear more about that, how toxic it is there. But one thing that seemed surprising to us, given the amplification of the Tea Party movement by all the coverage of the recent gathering and the election of Scott Brown here in Massachusetts, it was surprising that many Americans, over a third, say they haven't heard or read anything about the Tea Party. And despite Scott Brown's election, only 17% of Americans say they're angry about Washington.
You know, a bit of a reality check for what this movement is and what it isn't. And I think the same goes for Sarah Palin, who a lot of folks think is likely to be a leader of the Tea Party movement. It's not clear at this point that this is something that can get the broad appeal of the middle. It's not really aligned with any political party, but I don't think it's right to equate the Tea Party movement with the rise of independence. That's more of a middle-of-the-road thing, people that want bipartisanship. The Tea Party folks do not want bipartisanship. They want a recommitment to first conservative principles.
Well, more results from the poll seem to go against what we've been hearing. For months, we've heard President Obama owns the economy now, but the poll shows that Americans remember that the recession started under George W. Bush. They largely blame him. Also, 60% say that the current president, Obama, understands the problems of Americans. 62% say Republicans do not. As you said, President Obama is not the one running in the midterm elections. But what does that mean?
Oh, I think it means that there's an inherent trust here, and maybe a hope that President Obama is the person that can pull people through this. But it's not clear that there's a basis for that, or that there's really a possibility for that. I think all along President Obama has dealt with these very high expectations, and it's been a double-edged sword for him. But I think he retains a base of support here that if he can re-energize and tap into again and remind members of Congress that it's there, then he really almost stands alone in this environment as someone who people are at least willing to give a shot and rally around.
Well, but he's got a tough job. You describe this toxic climate there. Is it completely frozen? And I'm not making yet another joke about the snow, but is it just completely locked there?
This is Washington at its most dysfunctional. You're right. It has nothing to do with the fact that you can't get around the town because of the snow. It has to do with the fact that there is nothing moving on Capitol Hill. The initiatives from the White House are landing with a thud. Democrats and Republicans, every time you have a glimmer of bipartisanship like we had just yesterday with a jobs proposal in the Senate, it gets squashed. There's nothing substantial that's moving. There's really no chance of major advances on legislation on the climate change issue right now, on jobs and the economy. That's stalled. Obviously, healthcare is famously stalled. All of these things are just kind of stuck in a major rut right now.
Well, it's not just, as you write, the Republicans in the minority saying no. It's the Democrats fighting with each other, including just give us a sense of what you describe as a seething House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi, seething at the White House.
Yeah, she is, I think, increasingly frustrated at where the White House, how the White House has led. They haven't had enough direction on health care. In her view, and I think a view of a lot of House members, the White House hasn't been kind of cracking the whip with the Senate. They've seen major pieces of legislation like the cap and trade bill, like a jobs bill more recently, like the health care bill, die either in the Senate or after it passes the Senate because of where the Senate math is. And the feeling from a lot of folks in House leadership right now is that they've done everything they could do. They've held up their end of the bargain, and it's really up to the White House and the Senate to pick that up.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News and author of that network's blog, The Note. Rick, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Question for you. What happens to the human brain when a person has a stroke? It's a question that neuroscientist Jill Bolte Taylor had considered for years, and then at age 37, she experienced the answer firsthand when Dr. Bolte Taylor had a severe hemorrhage in the left hemisphere of her brain, the side responsible for ego and logic and language. She couldn't speak or read or walk. But then her brain's right lobe, the side responsible for creativity and empathy, took over, and she says she experienced a peace, an enlightenment, while almost dying. Dr. Bolte Taylor has recovered fully over the course of 8 years. We should probably say that her interest in the brain was driven from a young age by the fact that her brother is schizophrenic, and she now advocates for stroke victims and the mentally ill. She told her story in the New York Times bestseller, My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey. And today we want to revisit the conversation we had with Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor when that book first came out. We asked her to begin the morning of the stroke.
On the morning of December 10, 1996, I woke up and I had a pounding pain behind my left eye. And I thought, okay, I've got a headache going on. I'm going to start my normal routine. So I jumped onto my cardioglider and I'm exercising away on this thing. And I looked at my hands and my hands looked like primitive claws grasping onto the bar. And I looked down at my body and my body, I seemed to be separated from the normal perception of reality where I'm the person on the machine having the experience to some esoteric perspective where I'm witnessing myself having this perspective.
Right.
So I got off the machine and I noticed immediately that everything inside of my body had slowed way down. And I got into the shower and I lost my balance in the shower and I was leaning up against the wall. And the atoms and molecules of my arm seemed to blend in with the atoms and molecules of the wall. And I could no longer define the boundaries of where I began and ended.
You write you felt enfolded by a blanket of tranquil euphoria. At one point, you think, well, this is kind of cool. And there was sort of a seduction to it. That's stunning to me.
It was really beautiful. I no longer had the boundaries of where I began and ended, so I had the sense that I was as big as the universe, and the normal brain chatter that connected me to the external world and anything that in my life that had been stressful was gone. But then periodically, my left hemisphere brain chatter would come back online and essentially shock me back into normal reality.
Right.
But it wasn't until my right arm went totally paralyzed by my side that I realized, oh my gosh, I'm having a stroke. But, you know, through the eyes of a brain scientist, this is like an exhilarating moment in time. It's like, here I have this opportunity to witness the degeneration, the deterioration of my thought processes from the inside out, and what insight that could be into helping the medical community really better understand what is going on inside of the brain.
Okay, I want to hold you up in this compelling story. You know, next you realize you have to, as you said, get help, and that was an excruciating process of trying to figure out how to work a phone again and staring at a phone keypad. But do tell us, though, what was happening in your brain that, for instance, you felt this oneness? It increases as you go through this experience, and you felt, you know, this sense of you don't really have a boundary. You're at one with the world. What is happening in the brain that's helping that to happen?
Well, the left hemisphere is my ability to connect to information that I've brought up from my past and be able to apply that to the present moment in order to project what's going to happen in the future. So when that hemorrhage happened inside of my left hemisphere, it forced the left hemisphere offline, leaving me with just what's going on in the right hemisphere. Right. And so, it was beautiful there.
Beautiful, but also there's a sense of urgency. You know you have to pay attention. I'm reading here. Holding onto the phone was like holding onto a slippery fish, and you're saying to yourself, hold on to the fish, hold on to understanding that this is a phone, hold on for the next moment of clarity. It takes 45 minutes just to figure out who and how to call and how to call for help.
Right.
And then you start matching squiggles on papers to squiggles on phone pads. You're even losing a sense of what a number is, but you feel you can just match it to the keypad. Then what happens?
I finally get the whole number dialed. My colleague answers the phone, and he says to me, "Roar, roar, roar, roar." And I realize, oh, my gosh, he sounds like a golden retriever, and I can't understand what he's saying. And so then I say to him, "This is Jill. I need help." But what comes out of my mouth is, "Roar, roar." So in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, language is out.
Well, you finally do get to the hospital, several hospitals. You continue to sort of fall into this wonderful void. As you write, you don't have your language center anymore telling you who you are, and so you feel no obligation to be that person. You just are going to be what? What are you at this point? How do you perceive yourself?
I perceive myself as an infant in a woman's body. I was in an absolutely silent mind. It was not communicating to me, my name is Jill, this is where I live, these are the things I like or dislike. Yet I still existed. A little piece of me was still alive and conscious and perceiving. I just had zero language and no skills capable of understanding when others spoke or interacted with me. At the same time, my right hemisphere had natural talents of its own. It could read body language. It could read facial language. It could pick up energy dynamics. Everything was the big picture of context. So I had lost the left hemisphere that's capable of taking the big picture and breaking it apart into the fine details. But I still existed. And from my perspective, even though I couldn't walk, talk, read, write, or have any recollection of my life, I still perceived myself as perfect and whole and beautiful. Everybody else was freaking out, but I was okay.
Well, you say, imagine everything radiates pure energy. With childlike curiosity, your heart soars in peace. Your mind explores new ways of swimming in a sea of euphoria. Then ask yourself, how motivated would you be to come back? Mm-hmm. So did you have to fight a seduction? Did you have to, because your mother comes to care for you. All your friends are there. Many of the doctors know you and are trying to pull you over almost. Is that how it felt, pulling you away from that seduction?
I needed them to seduce me out of this because the euphoria and bliss was a natural space where I really wanted to go. It was pain-free. It was beautiful. So it really had to take people in the external world who loved me gently in order to want to try to reconnect.
That's Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, a brain scientist, also author of My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey. By the way, this week there was news about strokes. The journal Neurology reports that studies show people who suffer migraines may have a higher risk. So doctors are now saying those suffering migraines should be careful about curbing risk factors like high blood pressure, cholesterol, and obesity. We're going to take a minute break. When we come back, a lot of people told Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor that she had a religious experience during her stroke. She doesn't think she did, and we'll hear her response. Also later today, yesterday, we talked about the risks of imposing Western thinking about mental health on other countries. Well, today, an American psychiatrist talks about the fine line Westerners walk in the country she worked in, Ethiopia. That's later today. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been hearing the story of Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, a brain scientist who had a debilitating stroke at the age of 37, but one that she says produced pure bliss. During her recovery, Jill couldn't speak or understand language, but she was very much affected by people's moods. For instance, there was a hospital nurse that took care of Jill and was abrupt. Jill called her an energy vampire. When we spoke with Jill in 2008, we mentioned that and said that her story seemed to be a cautionary tale for caregivers. She seemed to really rely on them to woo her back from a bliss to an often cranky real world.
Well, you know, one of my messages, I think, is take responsibility for the energy you bring into any room, much less the room of someone who is ill, because they may not be picking up on anything else, but they may be picking up on your energy. It was real clear to me when someone was totally preoccupied with their to-do list and they were not present and available for me. And if the caregivers were not available for me, then why would I even bother to try?
You'd always been involved with the mentally ill. You're now very involved with stroke victims. How universal was your experience? And, you know, people desperately want to know. I want to know. My mom had a couple of strokes, and she always seemed so frightened. Do you think that your experience, this sort of nirvana, had more to do with you? Or what, you know, what are you saying about it?
I think it has to do with the very specific circuitry in the brain that gets disturbed. I was very fortunate that when that circuitry went offline, I felt euphoria. I've had lots of emails from people who have said, you have described my experience beautifully. Thank you for putting words to it. I've had other emails from other individuals who have pretty clearly defined themselves as having problems with their right hemisphere, and they haven't had that experience at all. And perhaps they've lost the big picture, which I gained, and they now get caught up in the left hemisphere details. And the details are much more difficult. You know, that's part of your stress circuitry. And if all I'm running is my stress circuitry, then I can't find relief.
Well, and, you know, people have said that you know, had not a left hemisphere experience, but a religious experience. And you've been asked to appear on radio and TV programs by people who claim to see angels. And how do you feel about being so embraced by those believers?
You know, to me, it's all about semantics. Somebody who's comfortable with the phrase God uses God. But for me, it's circuitry. And I just really don't get at all hung up on the language. I'm just glad, really, that people are talking about their brains. They're open to the possibility that perhaps we really are wired for this peacefulness. And boy, if more of us hooked into that wiring, then we would be feeling and experiencing more of that peace and projecting that into the world.
Well, on the other hand, while some have wanted to embrace you as some sort of representation of some enlightenment, there are others who have been very critical of you, who've said this is brain damage and this is just, you know, confusion. And some people have said the same feeling can be achieved through drugs, you know, the brain. And, you know, to assign it to sort of a euphoria or a nirvana, which to some means some sort of transcendence, is inaccurate.
Right. Well, you know, I think everybody's got an opinion. It's the beauty of the left hemisphere. It's part of how we're wired. And I think that the left hemisphere has a tendency to want to ridicule. And, you know, that's a group of cells in your brain. That was a group of cells that wanted to come back online in my brain. And I said, no, I don't need that little mean voice anymore.
You know, I feel I should ask you more directly. Do you think you had a religious experience? Do you think you glimpsed God? Do you think that's what part of that euphoria was?
I think that what happened in my brain was I lost part of the circuitry in my left hemisphere, and it felt like euphoria to me. I felt that I was at one with all that is. And to think that you know, I can track a moving target through space only because I have cells that perform that function. And perhaps our ability as a people to experience God is through that specific circuitry, then great. But I view it all as circuitry. And because of the circuitry, we have the capacity for what we are as living beings.
Well, from a fetal position in your apartment to major surgery to a long, long recovery process to here you are back. Do you miss that place you were, that euphoria, even though you were in the flesh immobile?
No, I don't really, because I never had to give it up. And I think that one of the things about circuitry is, you know, whatever you focus your mind on is that circuitry. And the more you think about those thoughts and the more you run that circuit, then the stronger those circuits become. And so for me, I had 5 full weeks of just this pure right hemisphere experience of euphoria. And I got to bring it along with me through the process of recovery. I got to add new things to it, but that didn't take away from my ability to say, but that's just circuitry. I don't have to think those thoughts anymore.
Yeah, but as you wrote, you know, it was a place when you lost the old Jill where you weren't even conscious of your parents' divorce, which had been painful. And now you're back in that world where you are conscious of those things. I mean, are you just saying that you've brought some of that ability to transcend some of those things back with you? Is that?
No, I never reopened all those files. Ah. All of that emotional baggage was gone.
Huh.
And so, yes, I learned that my parents were divorced, but none of the triggers were there anymore.
Wow.
So I got to be essentially have a new birth and begin again. And I didn't have to go back to the old person. I didn't have to go back to her likes or dislikes. I didn't have to go back to her emotional baggage. It's really been an incredible opportunity to come back into the world as an adult with a whole new attitude.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, do you stumble across someone who says, you know, you realize you're being a little tentative and intermittent because you had a fight or something, and you don't have, as you said, you don't have that memory of angst. Have you come across old friends who need to tell you what some of your background is or with them?
Well, I had one person contact me and say, I know we went separate ways on bad terms and I'd like to make up for that. And I wrote back and said, I'm sorry, I don't remember. So, to me, we're at peace.
The funny thing is, I just got an email like that from a friend in high school, and I didn't have a stroke, and I don't remember it either. So,
exactly. You don't have to hold on to that stuff.
That's Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, author of My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey. We spoke with her when her book first came out in 2008. Well, looking ahead, next week on Here and Now, we just heard about pressure on incumbents. We're going to speak with conservative radio host J.D. Hayworth, who's looking at Senator John McCain's seat. That's Monday. Still ahead today, a love story born in slavery. But the latest news is next, Here and Now. Have you tried online dating? You get to read wonderful profiles of people, see their pictures, and then the online chatting begins. Let's say you've been skiing recently. Oh, look, he's been skiing too. He writes, I just got back from Aspen. How are the slopes in your area? Isn't that wonderful? You're interested in the same things. Wait a minute. What if that wasn't written by the guy you thought it was? What if it was a sort of cyber-age Cyrano who, like the classic French character, is writing for someone else? That's exactly what Brooklyn-based Matt Prager does. He's a therapist and life coach who's hired to craft other people's online dating images. Matt, can you explain what you do?
Basically, what I do is I help people sort of manage their online dating lives. I think of myself as more Avatar, frankly, than Cyrano.
Because you're not, going to fall for these people. You are helping out your clients.
That's correct. Online dating went from being something that was a creepy way to meet people to the only way to meet people. And I think in the course of that transition, it has become like a second job, the managing of the contacting people and the going through the profiles and the writing the profile and all of that. And basically, my service started up to kind of offload that work.
And when people first asked you to do it, you thought that was creepy, like, I can't do that, but then you kind of got into it. What's it like? I mean, how do you get in the heads of these people? You have to represent them.
I guess it's sort of combined two things I've been doing with my life. I was a writer in Hollywood for many years, and then I switched and got my graduate degree and became a therapist.
And who exactly are these clients?
Very rich men in their late 30s, mid 40s, some married and divorced with kids, that kind of thing, and some who just spent their whole lives in the office and kind of woke up and were like, wow, I want to get into a relationship.
Okay, so now we figured out what you do, Matt Prager.
Yes.
This is terrible. I mean, don't you feel a twinge of guilt that there are people who may be thinking, for instance, that that guy that they are meeting online is actually a really good writer? It's you. It's not the guy that they're ultimately going to meet.
Sure. Well, I guess I would say two things to that. I mean, one is for the millions of people who put up a picture that's 5 years and 20 pounds ago, I don't know that my deception is that much more beyond that. And the other thing is, I guess I would say this, the women of the world should be praying it's me on the other end, because at least I'm actually reading their profiles, and look at them and think, oh, are you going to match with the person? A real matchmaker knows both parties. I don't. I only know one. But I'm trying, at least, to maximize both parties on the date. The goal is to get to that date and have them click. Once they meet, I'm out of the picture.
A couple questions. First of all, have you had success stories?
Sure. I mean, but don't forget, success is based on sort of a client's definition of success, not societal definition of, oh, they wound up married. I mean, many clients are just looking to date. They're looking to kind of get out there. They're traveling a lot for work. They have the kids. They're looking to sort of meet people and have a busy social life.
But also, are you sure you're out of the picture? I mean, let's say it's women mostly who are meeting these men. Do they ever find out that you were involved?
Yeah, I actually heard about one where the client confessed, and it was in the context of the woman confessing something she lied about in her profile. And he was like, well, that's okay, because you've been talking to me for the last 3 weeks.
Doesn't it get a little hard for you to keep track? Do you ever slip up? You find yourself, representing the wrong one, or is it hard to keep them all straight?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I actually had a piece of software custom designed so I could keep track of exactly that.
Oh, no, this is terrible. This is so taking the romance out of what little there was. Is yours a cautionary tale? Is this, just a reminder to people that when you're online, you just don't really know who's on the other side?
I believe with online dating, it's all fake until you get to the real. For all I know, I'm talking to someone else's proxy. I don't know. Right? So, I mean, it's just that I think my goal, at least for my clients, is get to the real. Get into the room with the person and make your assessment. And then they're on their own. Make your own decision about whether you want to pursue something.
That's Matt Prager, a therapist, a life coach, and now an online avatar. As he said, he sort of helps people craft their online dating. Matt, thanks so much, and happy Valentine's Day to you.
To you as well, Rob. Thanks a lot.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
And we'd love to hear from you, hereandnow.org. You can click on Contact Us or leave a comment right there on the homepage, hereandnow.org. We trust it's you. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now.
A lot of kisses on the bottom. I'll be glad I got them. I'm going to smile and say,
you may have heard our story yesterday with science writer Ethan Waters. His new book, Crazy Like Us, makes the case that despite the best intentions, the U.S. often exports Western thinking about mental health, and in so doing, actually may spread mental health problems. For instance, Hong Kong had no anorexia related to girls wanting to be thin until the 1990s, when stories of American anorexia made their way there. Also this week, Haitian officials put out a call for mental health professionals, but included a plea that outsiders respect local culture and traditions. So we were already thinking about international mental health care when we heard from our old friend Dr. Suzanne Song. She's been on the program before, talking about her field work in Sierra Leone. Dr. Song is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist finishing up a fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry at Stanford. And she joins us again to talk about her recent field work in Ethiopia. And Suzanne, you tell us that you were surprised to find a program there started by a Canadian university to train Ethiopian psychiatrists. Why?
I was quite taken aback because it felt like an American psychiatry program. You know, there are grand rounds every week where a resident would look up a topic from an American psychiatric text and they would present it on PowerPoint. Keep in mind that this was at a time when there was electricity in the country only every other day, and so they would have one laptop they would use, and we would all watch in the dark. I think Canadian psychiatrists are trying to be very forward-thinking, and they're bringing the most advanced scientific psychiatry to Ethiopia. My concern was it didn't feel very applicable.
Well, that was in part because you saw that Ethiopians express their mental health problems in a different way than people in the West. For instance, you say some people would come in and say they had a ringing in their ears, but that was their way of talking about intense stress. And patients with depression described it as a burning scalp.
This is one of the most common issues that both men and women came with. This notion of their scalp basically burning or feeling some heat on their head, a way of expressing their depression and their severe pain.
Again, getting to the heart of the difficulty of Westerners going to other countries and being open to local thinking about mental health, you say that it's very hard to distinguish sometimes between autism in Ethiopia and serious malnutrition.
Yeah, so this is where the intersection of poverty and mental health are very clear. I mean, I saw children who they would tell me this child is, let's say, 17 years old, but he looked like he was 10 years old. It was just unclear if it was mental retardation, and because of the mental retardation, parents would then keep them in one room, so they weren't exposed to a lot of light or social interaction, and therefore they were stunted both physically, developmentally, or if it's truly something like autism.
This is what we've been hearing, that different countries either feel mental health problems in different ways or express them in different ways. And, you know, did you get concerned that if doctors are trained more and more from the American diagnostic or the Canadian diagnostic manuals, that you're going to start to have a disconnect?
Well, yes and no. So, I mean, I think that there are some disorders that are universal in construct. So I was surprised to see that schizophrenia and bipolar disorder crossed cultural boundaries. They share the same symptoms wherever you are. Now, that does not mean that they aren't influenced by culture, but there are some disorders where the symptoms cross cultural boundaries.
Ethan Waters has been critical of the way some Western healthcare providers have gone into countries and, let's say, if someone has schizophrenia, not understood that there might be cultural ways of dealing with schizophrenia. You're not saying that there should be a complete hands-off approach and these people shouldn't get treatment at all, but maybe combine the Western with what people already do in the country?
Yes. What I've mainly seen with schizophrenia is that people become psychotic, and let's say in the rural areas, and they don't have access to medical care. So the burden is mainly on the family to take care of them. So then families are then subjected to doing things that they might be morally against otherwise, which are things like tying people to trees, stoning them, keeping them locked up into rooms. I mean, so many patients came to me that were psychotic, and they were bound, you know, hands and feet bound, with four or five family members just completely helpless, not knowing what else to do. And it becomes a human rights abuse because people are suffering. And if we in the West have medications that can help alleviate suffering, then by all means, I'm for it. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to take people outside of their families or outside of their communities. We should definitely build upon strengths that are inherent in cultural beliefs that traditionally protect and support these communities.
Well, one of them, for instance, is that we understand Ethiopians, especially the Christians, believe that they should have holy water before going to see a doctor. Now, I can see somebody saying, oh, that's a very simple thing. Let's just allow it and combine that cultural belief with whatever then happens once they get to the doctor's office. But you point out a story about a young boy you met with epilepsy where that treatment alone can be disastrous.
Yeah, so there is a deep religiosity that permeates the culture in Ethiopia. If a child has a mental illness, which seizure disorder and epilepsy falls under mental illness in most low-income countries, then it's attributed to the wrath of God. And so it would make logical sense then to go to a traditional healer, where they typically will dunk the child in holy water and to be exorcised of their demons. I respect the reliance on a spiritual interpretation and treatment, except when there are negative consequences. So this boy was forced to drink a mixture of holy water and dirt, and he almost died from cholera-like diarrhea.
So it sounds like you're saying respect the cultural thinking, but to a point. But what else do you think Ethiopia needs? You've also said that you think Ethiopians should take over and develop their own mental health treatments. And you're calling for more low-level people to be trained to be paraprofessionals to go into the countryside because right now psychiatric care is centralized in big cities like Addis Ababa.
Yes. I mean, I had people coming from all over the country. They're taking 3 or 4 hours selling their last goat just to take that bus ride. And it's just not sustainable. And so if you can decentralize services and have more people trained out in the provinces, you can actually help a lot more people.
Dr. Suzanne Song, finishing up her fellowship at the Stanford Lucile Packard Children's Hospital, but she's talking about the field work that she's done studying mental health in Ethiopia. Dr. Song, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get a few of your thoughts in. Many of you appreciated our conversation with Dr. Thomas McClellan of the White House Drug Office. He plans to put more money into treatment of addiction, but his unwillingness to legalize marijuana outraged a lot of you. Graham Lerner of Chicago writes, "Thousands are killed or imprisoned for this war on drugs, this misguided and terribly executed effort to legislate morality." Alberto Castro wrote, after the former census director told us the new 2010 census doesn't ask about citizenship status. Well, Alberto says, hey, I'm looking at a form right now. Yes, it does. Well, we made some calls, and it turns out the 10-year census, the 2010 short form, does not ask, but there is a periodic long form, and that one does. Well, then there was our conversation with bullying expert Barbara Coloroso. We heard from a lot of you, including Brooke Monette from Ypsilanti, Michigan. She was bullied as a kid. She was body slammed, pulled by her hair, locked in her locker. A girl broke her nose. We decided to call Brooke up. Brooke, what was your school's response?
One of their responses was to restrict my playground access. And I assumed that, okay, if this means my being more safe, then that's fine. But it would go to things that would happen on the bus, things that would happen elsewhere. They brought in a counselor to talk with me about how I could become more normal because I wasn't fitting in, and so I was the problem, because it was easier to deal with me as a single student than it was to deal with a large social problem.
Yeah. At one point, Barbara Coloroso, you say, said something that had an impact on you. Now, you're 29 now. What did she say?
She said that, you know, if you're weird, if you're dorky, you're the odd man out. It's not you, despite the fact that this may cause these other children to see you differently. It's not your fault that they are mean and cruel. And that just, it's such a relief to hear.
Even now?
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for telling us about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we heard from Meg, a mom in Pennsylvania as well, and she was also brought to tears. She writes, "My twins' middle school had a Facebook page called I Hate So-and-So with 75 members. Kids had a Kick a Ginger Day where you kick a redhead. Then there's the huge pressure to be deep-rooted, to make out with someone. My good-looking, football-playing, kind and honest son feels humiliated that he's being teased because he's still a prude. Then there's our 10-year-old daughter. She's transgender. She's male-bodied, but an affirmed girl. I'm terrified of what will happen when she reaches middle school. For now, when kids are jerks, I teach her to put one hand on her hip, look at them, roll her eyes, and walk away, as if to say, 'You are so lame.' That works for now." You can always contact us as well at hereandnow.org. Well, from A Mother's Love, we leave you today with another love story from producer Nate DeMeo. It's about the unusual journey of two slaves through 19th century America.
When she was 11, Ellen Craft was given away as a present. She was born in 1826 in Clinton, Georgia. Her mother was a slave, and her father owned her mother. And Ellen inherited her father's looks and his light skin. People on the plantation would say the little girl looked like a member of her owner's own family. And this ate at the man's wife, having this girl around her house, reminding her of her husband's tastes and cruel habits. And when her own daughter married a gentleman from Macon, the couple got the little girl as a wedding gift. And the mistress of the plantation was rid of her. Ellen moved to Macon, where she worked the fields all day. And she met a man, another slave named William. And they fell in love and got married. And whispering in their bed at night, or when they passed in the fields or sat down for dinner, they plotted their escape. They knew that if they could get far enough out of Macon where no one knew them, Ellen could pass for white. But they also knew that wouldn't do it. A 22-year-old white woman traveling alone would have been weird. But a 22-year-old white woman traveling with a 20-something black man would be out of the question. But one night in 1848, Ellen and William ran into the dark woods and kept running. And when they were sure that they were far enough out of town, Ellen Craft became a white man. And this was hard to do. It wasn't as simple as cutting her hair short and putting on men's clothes, which wasn't very simple anyway. Ellen Craft had to learn to walk and talk convincingly like a young white man of means. And she didn't have any stubble, and she didn't have an Adam's apple. So if she slash he and her slash his slave manservant ran into any trouble with the police or someone at a state border, she wouldn't be able to read a document. She wouldn't be able to sign anything. And they had to move fast, because the disguise wasn't going to hold up for long. The only way to do it was to take public transportation. By the time Ellen and William boarded their first train, they figured out how to do it. A young southern gentleman had suffered a terrible accident. He needed to go to Philadelphia for some special medical treatment. He needed his trusty slave William along to care for him. The lower part of his face was injured and bandaged, which covered up his Adam's apple and beard. His leg had been conveniently injured too, so of course he walked a little funny. And his arm was in a sling, and he was terribly sorry, but he could only move it enough to make an X anytime he was asked to sign their tickets or travel documents. And the Crafts played their parts, traveling north on trains, in a passenger ship, and finally a ferry to Philadelphia. The abolitionists ate this story up. It had everything they were looking for to help spread an anti-slavery message. It had a cruel, vengeful slave owner. It had high drama, it had ingenious disguises, it even had romance. Soon the abolitionist press had made the Crafts the symbol of the struggle for freedom, and they more than took to the role. moving to Boston, the de facto capital of the anti-slavery movement, telling their story all over the Northeast, writing on the cause of liberty and basic human dignity in the barbarism of American slavery. And it made them famous. And so their former slave owners knew exactly where to find them. Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850. The law basically said that slaves were property, and lost property had to be returned, even if that property was now in a state where slavery was illegal. Even if a person had been living in freedom and working and building a business and a family in that state for decades. And so when the Crafts' former owner sent two agents to Boston to bring Ellen and William back, the city of Boston had to let them. The slave hunters got official warrants and everything. But the people of Boston didn't have to let them. A group of abolitionists hid Ellen in another town, and William grabbed a gun and holed up in the house of another former slave, Lewis Hayden, who had gone from working as a man's property in Kentucky to owning a big house on Boston's schmancy Beacon Hill. And when the slave hunters came looking for William, they were outnumbered and outgunned by free black men who didn't care about a warrant, and by Hayden, who stood on his doorstep with two kegs of gunpowder and a torch and told the hunters he was ready to blow them and his house and himself up rather than let them take William Craft. The slave hunters left, and soon the Crafts did too. They moved to England, where they kept writing and lecturing and telling their story for 20 years. 3 years after the Civil War, a time when the safety of free black Americans was still threatened in much of the country, and of course would be for decades and decades longer, Ellen and William Craft came back to the United States. And they didn't move back to Boston or Philadelphia, where many people would have welcomed them as conquering heroes. Ellen died in Way Station, Georgia, in 1891, where she and her husband and children had lived for 23 years, growing rice and cotton and teaching at a school they founded. She was buried under a tree on the plantation that she owned.
Our story about the Crafts came from producer Nate DeMeo's Memory Palace. To hear more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Happy Valentine's Day, and join us again here and now.